Hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You are listening to KGVM, Bozeman Community Radio, broadcasting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. Well, we are doing better this week. The temperatures have gotten me out for a walk, and this week we even had a day of several inches of fluffy snow. I'm loving getting out in the sunshine again, but I'm still avoiding crowded areas. This week we have music provided by Beloved Mountain, along with some bird sounds from Acoustic Atlas and the Macaulay Library. And I hope you like me reading to you after the station break, because I'm going to be doing that. Well, today's episode of Desert Oracle Radio was produced by Ken Lane just a couple days ago on January 19th, 2024. It is titled Murder on the California Backroads.
Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
This is a story about when I was a young newspaper reporter. This story starts when I'm a reporter out in the Avocado Hills of Fallbrook, California, which is, which was then. It's more suburban than anything now. Still very pretty, but it's a country town. It's tucked under Camp Pendleton, the Marine base, north of San Diego. It's in the Santa Margarita Mountains as part of the Pacific Coast Ranges. You know, they run from the Yukon to the Sierra Madre. That whole coast is one chain of mountains. Fallbrook, even now, I was there not long ago, but in the 80s, 90s especially, it felt a long ways, you know, from anywhere. It was like 25 minutes through farms and chaparral and whatever past the Mission, the San Luis Rey River from Oceanside. So I worked at this daily newspaper, and I could make it from Fallbrook to Oceanside in 15 minutes late at night when the road was empty, because you had to go type your story in at the paper. We had this ancient newspaper computer system that we called Mother. And everybody called it Mother, you know, sometimes with reverence, sometimes like in agony as you see your text just disappearing. It's like, ah! And sometimes as part of the popular two-word phrase, it starts with Mother. And I'd race back and type my stories. You know, I covered the planning division meetings. I covered the Avocado Festival, the Farm Bureau. And we had the White Aryan Resistance out there, too. We had Tom Metzger, who had War, the White Aryan Resistance, he lived there, riling up the skinheads. You know, I'd go interview him sometimes because he was always in the news. He got beat up on Geraldo Rivera's show. Like, it was a talk show, you know, and the skinheads start fighting and banging chairs on each other's heads.
You said Geraldo. I was like, you got to be more specific. There was a lot of that on there.
Well, Geraldo had a talk show in, like, the 80s. Like, Jerry Springer picked up that whole thing. But I think Geraldo and Phil Donahue were doing it first.
Kind of the OGs, yeah.
Yeah, and it was just like a talk show, and they'd have a bunch of yahoos in the audience, and they'd bring these people out and just basically egg them on to start fighting. Tom Metzger was this clown, and he got shut down by Southern Poverty Law Center. They kind of sued him out of business because these skinheads up in Portland, Oregon killed this guy. And they did a civil, and the Southern Poverty Law Center did a civil case, murder encouragement or something. So there was some news out there, but it was also the sticks. Meanwhile, back in Oceanside, which is a sleazy Marine Corps town, they got a waste disposal mafia. They got fights in the streets, you know, hookers everywhere, drug dens. It was just a great news town. But there was a little quiet neighborhood kind of outside the main part of the town. And there was this cute little girl named Leticia Hernandez. And she was playing outside in her parents' very tiny fence front yard in this neighborhood of little stucco houses. And her mother and I believe her grandmother were both about 6 feet away. The front door's open, the windows are open. Friends and relatives lived on either side. You know, there's lots of grandmas on front porches. This was the old working class Mexican neighborhood of Oceanside. And Leticia Hernandez, she's 7 years old. She just disappears. She's there 1 minute. She's playing with her dolls right outside the front door. A little garden sized thing with flower beds and a mailbox and a fence and a little walkway to the door. And she vanished. And we did not have a lot of those stories in those days. So the whole town is covered in flyers with her first grade school picture. She's got her braided ponytail over her shoulder, smiling, and is cutest little girl. And all the police reporters were on the story, and it's a big deal. It makes the LA news, it makes the big TV news shows. We were about 90 minutes south of Los Angeles. Like in the Tom Waits song, Diamonds, Diamonds on My Windshield. You know, he says, like, Oceanside, it ends the ride. San Clemente coming up, you know. So all these front page stories, all the flyers and the searches, they add up to nothing. The girl is gone. So after it calms down a little bit, Art Bell, the late night radio host, who was out of Las Vegas at the time, it's a clear
coast
channel.
Coast. Yeah.
I don't remember if it had become Coast to Coast yet as the title.
Yeah.
He had some different titles, but he was on late night and he was doing this thing. You know, this is end of 1989, beginning of 1990. And it's a clear channel in the West. So you pick it up at night everywhere. Everybody, if you had your radio on, you listen to Art Bell. And he's got a psychic on the line, a guy named John Monte. And I want to read you a couple lines from this United Press International Wire story I dug up. This is from April 3rd, 1981, a decade earlier. Dateline Quincy, Massachusetts. A self-employed house painter who claims to have psychic powers predicted on a taped radio show on March 4 that President Ronald Reagan would be shot sometime toward the end of March, but would survive. Psychic John Monte, 30, of Quincy, told the Brockton Enterprise that on March 3, he had a premonition about the president, which he wrote down. Monte announced it on a telephone hookup with a New Hampshire radio station the next day. The prediction was confirmed by the station, WKBR of Manchester, New Hampshire. This is what he wrote. There is sadness around President Reagan. I feel he will be shot in the left side of his body after a speech in Washington. I feel it will happen by the end of March, but the president will live. So he read it the next night on WKBR, which featured him on a two-hour talk show hosted by Rudy Nelson. In confirming that Monte made the prediction on his 6 to 8 p.m. talk show March 4, Nelson said, quote, "We consider him our resident psychic. The phones go bananas when he's on." Monte gives his predictions from his Quincy apartment by telephone. So Reagan was shot on March 30th and survived after being shot on his left side and the chest. And the guy who shot him is a popular liberal on Twitter now. So it goes.
Yeah.
So other people claim to have the premonition as well, but Monty's was confirmed. And he had a pretty good track record before that, although later in life, as he got better known after the incident I'm going to tell you about, you'd see his predictions in a National Enquirer or whatever. They pay you when you've gotten a little notoriety as a psychic, and those were all, you know, no good. But Johnny Monte had helped out a number of New England cold cases. He would touch things belonging to missing people. The victim, whoever it was, and he'd get these impressions. And he was pretty well known in New England from the crime section of the newspaper when Stephen King wrote The Dead Zone, about a mild-mannered psychic named Johnny Smith. But Johnny Monty, he'd found a three-year-old boy in Maine who'd been kidnapped from Northern California and survived. Monty led the police to him. So
that, this guy had like some bona fides.
Oh,
like,
yeah,
he had
yeah.
a good track record. Yeah.
Yeah, he was for real. He did not make any claims that he was never wrong or anything, but sometimes he got these impressions. So yeah. That's why he's on Art Bell. And this is in the weeks after the disappearance of Leticia Hernandez. So a radio listener in Oceanside or somewhere in North San Diego County heard him on the show, calls in on the West of the Rockies line, and asked John Monty if he got any impression from hearing about this little seven-year-old girl, Leticia Hernandez. And he must have said something like, yeah, I'd need to be there, stand in the place where she vanished, etc. So my newspaper publisher, this old boy from Virginia, Tom Missett, this big tall guy with like a handlebar mustache and a suit and suspenders and everything, he hears about the radio show and he hires John Monty to fly out to California and find Leticia Hernandez. So they put a couple of cops reporters on the story, along with our one reporter who was bilingual, who spoke Spanish, Dan Trotta. And, you know, all I could do was watch from afar because I'm out covering the Farm Bureau. But it was fascinating. And I did see him, though. I'd see him in the newsroom. And he was this kind of scatterbrained character. He seemed kind of lost in the world. He's always eating candy bars. He was like a little boy lost, you know? And he seemed sincere. Everybody liked him and sort of watched out for him. He'd never been to the West Coast. And Oceanside was just a wild town. Like, don't lose, you know, don't let him go out there. The hookers will get him or something. So he takes all these notes and he filled these yellow legal pads with impressions and thoughts and little drawings and single words, whatever. And after a week, he went home and his yellow legal pads went in a file cabinet in the newspaper's morgue. That's what newspapers called libraries, the morgue. This is where all the back issues were, the microfiche, you know, whatever. Stuff from big stories, investigations. So a year and 3 months passes from the time she disappeared, and then Leticia Hernandez's skull is discovered by a caretaker on a rural Indian reservation property on the side of a country two lane about 25 miles east of Oceanside, going up into the mountains. And by then, I was on the police beat. It was a year or so later, you know, they'd move you around different beats, and I wanted to be on the police beat. So I got put on the story, along with, once again, our bilingual reporter, Dan Trotta, who was still there. And I spent a couple of days and really sleepless nights going through all the backstories, and especially his yellow legal pads, which I'd take home every night and just sit there with a cup of coffee, going through them. A lot of them were notes, like names of streets he was on, people he met, you know, writing down dates, just like notes for himself. But then there were things that just didn't make much sense, kind of sketches, drawings, whatever. And I start talking to John on the phone, long distance. He's back east again and trying to make some sense of these notes he left. And he told me, he said, she was dead by the time I was there, but I couldn't say that, you know? I was there with her parents and everything. They were so hopeful. They, like, her Christmas presents were still under the tree the second Christmas after she was gone. But he said, when I was there, she had been killed. I felt that very strongly. So then the coroner's report comes out, and it confirms it. It says she likely died about 3 months after her abduction. So Dan Trotta and I decide we're going to go up and check out the property a couple days after the news. I spoke to John Monte on the phone again the morning before. Yeah, there's no suspects. It's just a skull. The rest of her wasn't there. I called John again. I said, look, Dan, he knew Dan Trotta. I said, Dan and I are going to drive out there to where she was found. Do you have, you know, any impressions, any thoughts, anything? And he didn't really. But before I say I got to go, he says, oh, take care of yourself out there. It's not going to be a very friendly day out there. Somebody's going to pull a gun on you. And then he pauses. And he says, but no one's going to shoot. Just be careful, be polite. I said, oh yeah, I'll be real polite if anybody pulls a gun on me, you know? And he pauses again, and then he says, actually, two people are going to pull guns on you and Dan. A rifle and a handgun. But no one's getting hurt, no gunfire, just be careful. So I tell Dan that as we're driving out on the little two-lane, and he starts shaking his head. He's like, are you sure you want to go out there? Well, we're just going to look at the place and see if there's anything, because all it was side of the road. What is, you know, that there's not a lot of closure in that. So we go off, we pull off on the side of the road. It's the 76, California 76. We park, we were in my pickup, and we get out and we're walking around, and Dan says, oh, look, there's some police tape. So we walk over where the police tape is, and there's some old oak trees, you know, California live oaks, and just rural hills. We're looking around, there's really nothing to see. And all of a sudden this guy says, hey! And we look over, and there's this Indian dude across from us in the trees, and he's got a rifle or a shotgun pointed right at us. And I kind of raise my eyebrows over to Dan, and he just nods. And I say, hi, we're just from the newspaper in Oceanside. And he says, this is private land. I'm the caretaker here. You know, you're not allowed. I said, look, I didn't see any no trespassing signs. We're 10 feet off the road. We're not doing anything. And he's like, yeah, well, you better da da da. And at that moment, a CHP black and white goes by, sees what's going on, stops. That guy runs out and draws his service revolver or whatever he's got. And there we go, two guns pulled on us within 2 minutes or something. So now the caretaker guy lowers his, and he says, I'm the caretaker here, it's legal for me to da da da. And he's like, okay, buddy, just, you know, put it down. He's like, what are you guys doing? We've got on tie, you know, we look like reporters. We got on like button downs and ties, and we're holding notepads. We're from the newspaper. This is where the girl's skull was discovered. And so everybody calms down and it's resolved. Thank God, you know. Although that would have been a dramatic end. Because the cop would have killed everybody, you know. Two reporters and a Indian reservation caretaker were shot dead by a CHP. So it works out. Then we drive back. And as we drive back and we see the little green sign on the side of the road that says leaving the Indian reservation, this is just bad vibes all around. Everything feels haunted here. In fact, over the years to come, there would be four or five bodies or parts of bodies of abducted girls and women that were found within about 100, 200 feet of there, thrown off the road into the woods right there. Another one came up about 10 years later. And I remember that one because they referenced Leticia Hernandez from 1991, beginning of 1991, in that story in the San Diego paper. So I get back to the newsroom and I go through those legal pads again. And I notice something I missed before. Every couple of pages in increasingly large, kind of frantic, scratch ballpoint handwriting, John had written the name Paula, P-A-U-L-A, you know, like Paula, underlined or circled or whatever. The skull of Leticia Hernandez was found on the Paula Indian Reservation, P-A-L-A, 25 miles east of Oceanside. It had been dumped there, the detective said, fairly recently before it was found. John Monte knew this a year before it happened and where it happened, but he did not know what it meant. He wasn't from around there. He had no idea there was a small rural Indian reservation with that same name with different spelling. So we all missed it, and we couldn't have done anything about it anyway, because it had not happened yet. Well, and that's the end of the sad story of Leticia Hernandez.
West of Washington, a little east of L.A.
Desert Oracle Radio.
Of all the restaurants in Tucson, which serves the best chimichanga?
Gordo's!
Which restaurant was singled out for outstanding cleanliness?
Gordo's!
The best chimichanga served in the cleanest restaurant at the lowest price, Gordo's. So if you like chimichangas, I mean if you really like chimichangas, come to Gordo's on Broadway, just west of Cole.
Well, it's 2024. Planes are falling out of the sky. Bombs are falling all over the world, and most of them have a Made in the U.S. of A label. The internet search results are a bunch of artificially intelligent garbage. Scrape from scam websites. The last of the written word publications are getting rid of the last humans and or shutting down altogether. Interest rates are still killing people trying to pay off credit cards they have to use in order to just get by. Health insurance is still killing people by the truckload to shave off another couple of pennies per dollar in hospital reimbursements. And to save democracy in 20 and 24, one of the political parties is not allowing elections in the primary season. While hoping it can get the other party's front runner behind bars or at least out of the country before the end of the year, sometimes you have to repeatedly kill the patient to save the patient, as they say in the health insurance sector. But I've still got my Christmas tree up, a beautiful noble fir that's keeping most of its needles standing right outside the radio studio. The little white lights cheerfully twinkling. And I'm still holding up this little wild bouquet. As the Bard of Montreal says, I hope you had a good solstice and Christmas and New Year's and MLK Junior Day stretched out over 3 or 4 weeks with a few actual holidays thrown in there if you're lucky. A few crumbs. I've been up at the hot springs with the Holy Mountain in view. I had decided while I was up there to suspend this radio show for a while, on hiatus, etc., and try to shop it around, see if I can get somebody, a station, something, to put a little money into it, do a weekly live broadcast, as I've longed to do, since I came up with this idea a dozen years ago. Two versions of the idea. This is one of them. So I sent in the notice to my local station and nobody saw it. Nobody read the email. What the hell? I thought it over for another week and decided, all right, I'll go ahead and do tonight's show, which features my friend Tom Sexton goading me on during the story about the psychic Johnny Monty. I had a live version of that story from the Hukumba Halloween show, but the recording was fried. Somebody was standing right by the field recorder and back, and she kept saying, the whole time, and probably nobody else in the room could hear it, but it's pretty much all that the field recorder picked up. That's about 7 out of 10 of my live show recordings, by the way, which is why you never hear most of them. The perils of a one-man show. So thanks to Tom and Terrence at the Trillbillies podcast for letting me borrow a bunch of that story originally recorded for their 2023 Halloween special. But now with a red, blue, black, silver soundtrack. This is year 8 and season 10 of this show, I guess. And soon I must do the unpleasant act of starting to put some, most of the new episodes behind the paywall. I don't have to tell you why. We know what's going on out there. So if you already contribute to our Patreon at desertoracle.com, you know I appreciate it, and you will be getting a lot more exclusive content, as I say over in our corporate branding and exploitation department. And I'm going to be doing more stories like I did tonight. That's a subject near and dear to my heart because it has been the entirety of my working life these past 40 years. Next time I go on the road on tour, I'll be doing a show called... What is it called? I don't know if I'm set on the title yet, but it's a storytelling show, a one-man show, as they say, about all the weird and ridiculous adventures I've had as a working writer, journalist, reporter, editor, all over the world, war all the time, often of my own making, including the 10 years of doing Desert Oracle and all kinds of strange excursions with stranger people. A cast of characters that includes Sarah Palin, Hunter Thompson, the Papa John's guy, Hulk Hogan, Lorne Michaels, Edward Abbey, Herb Cain, Sarah Kay Smith, Jim Newell, Matt Welch, Bob Shear, Will Hurst, Anna Merlin, Mojo Nixon, Country Dick Montana, Nick Denton, Corey Sika, Alex Perrine, Fran Lebowitz. Characters in the stories, I mean. They won't be on stage. You'll be hearing some of those stories on the podcast over the coming months as I type them up and mixed in with the Desert Oracle material. It's all Desert Oracle material. The Typing Life. I think that's what the show is called. Desert Oracle Radio presents The Typing Life with Ken Lane. That's what it says here on the Playbill cover.
This is the best thing that's happened to typing since electricity. The IBM Selectric typewriter.
So that's a rare editor's note on this radio show. Thanks to Red, Blue, Black, Silver. Thanks to you for listening. And good night from the voice of the desert.
We are at the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay on KGVM 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio. I've been doing a lot of reading lately as I was getting well from COVID, and I want to share some of my finds with you now. The severe cold last weekend brought a huge flock of gray-crowned rosy finches to our feeders, so let's start with that.
Here's a little poem that I wrote about the gray-crowned rosy finches back in January of 2021. Oh, I wish you could see it. This morning, as always on these chill days, I scattered seed on the deck, and they came. A flock of over 200. Come from their hidden roosts, circling like a great school of fish, they wheel and turn together. Each iteration comes closer to our house, to our deck, until silver wings wash over the railing again and again, like surf. With each wave, many land, till all have joined. Now the deck sparkles with bobbing gray heads. In minutes, they lift nearly as one, and they're gone. Smoothed like a beach, the deck is quiet. Chickadees comb for remnants. Well, if you've listened to this program very much, you know that I'm a bit of a nature nerd. One of my favorite books about the natural world is, it's actually a series, and it's called Awesome Possum. And it is put together by Angela Doyle. She's the editor. She also does some of the writing and art for the book. But what she does is she brings in writings and art from what I would call naturalists or citizen scientists all over the place that are just so informative and entertaining. The illustrations are great. I highly recommend this series. You might have to look for it online or check out your local independent bookstore and see if they can find it for you. But what caught my attention this week was an introduction to Volume 4 of this production, and it's written by Ursula Vernon, and I just loved it. I share a lot of her sentiments, so I'm going to read it to you. She writes, "So I have a hobby that some people may consider peculiar. I like to take photographs of moths. These are not good photographs, I hasten to add. This is not high art. I am not trying to get moth glamour shots here. I just want to get the field marks. And then I email the photo off to a website where they identify it and drop a little pin on the map to indicate the sighting. I'm not an entomologist. I came to bugs late in life. This is citizen science in its most basic form, with somebody who didn't know a leafhopper from a luna moth when she started out. Over the course of a couple years, I've ID'd nearly 300 moth species in my garden. The first few were on a whim, but then I got hooked. I think it was the names that did it. How can you not love the false underwing, and the intractable Quaker, and the stinging rose? Some seem like bizarre projection. What makes the grateful midget grateful, anyway? And some are almost sinister, like the laugher, or the hickory horned devil. I fell in love, and the love persisted through a luna moth flying into my face like a terrified bird, and the discovery of asp caterpillars lurking in the garden, which look like tiny toupees and sting like death. The first time I found a moth and logged to the first report of that species in my whole state, I had to go lie down for a few minutes with a cold cloth over my eyes. It didn't seem possible that I had found something glommed onto my door frame and nobody else had reported one. But it's not that they were rare, it's only that hardly anybody was looking. It's easy in our modern world to perceive nature as something happening out there. Nature is lions on the savannah, penguins trudging through Antarctica, grizzly bears flipping salmon in Alaskan streams. All glorious and magnificent and impressive, of course, but unless you happen to actually live in one of those places, there's an unreality to those images. They're off in a distance, probably being narrated by Sir David Attenborough. This is not to disparage Sir David Attenborough. In fact, nobody better disparage him in my hearing. I will fight you. But when we put nature out there, happening somewhere else, we lose sight of the fact that nature is all around us and we are interacting with it all the time. Sure, lions are awesome. I love a good penguin documentary as much as the next person. But at the end of the day, most people's experience with nature will be the nature that lives in our own backyards. The urban hawk and the suburban fox. The pigeons perched on power lines and the squirrels using telephone wires as their own personal highways. Even the moths at the porch light. Depending on where you live, you may have hedgehogs in the leaf piles or armadillos stomping through the brush, but it's almost a given that there will be something. It's all too easy to overlook these locals or to notice only a charismatic few. We take squirrels for granted, never stopping to notice the incredible engineering in their joints. We grumble over possums in the trash can, unaware of these weird primitive marsupials that have held for millions of years on a continent dominated by placental mammals. We marvel at the flight of the hummingbird and miss the hummingbird hawk moth. We point at the bald eagle in delight without realizing that it's probably stealing its meals from the hard-working local osprey or scavenging dead fish cast up on shore. When we look a little more closely at the nature that is all around us, even in cities and suburbs, we find a weird and delightful world of which humans form an inextricable part. That's a hard word for me. Anyway, she continues, cicadas hatch under our feet and emerge in broods to fill the air with buzzing. The local food chain expands to include trash cans and chihuahuas, and one time, my stepmom's miniature poodle. Eastern coyotes interbreed with dogs, cane toads cover golf courses, and ants form super colonies in the California suburbs. The volume you hold in your hands brings all that home. Some of the comics are subversive and funny. I'm still laughing over the rat in swimwear. And some are sweet and touched with wonder, like the history of fossil discovery in Dudley. It's natural science for the modern age. Hilarious, weird, thought-provoking, and right in our own backyards. And along the lines of nature, here's a little reading from Nature, A Day at a Time, An Uncommon Look at Common Wildlife by Kathy Katz. And her reading for January 21st, it opens with a quote by Oscar Wilde. He says, "The true mystery of the world is the visible, not the invisible." And then she's writing about lichens. She says, "Lichens are a combination of fungi and algae, each existing incognito while providing for the other's well-being. The body of a lichen is totally different from its independent members. Together, they form another entity, able to exist by offering what the other needs. Fungi absorb water, and they mine minerals that algae need. Algae create food, providing the sugars that fungi need. Of the thousands of lichen species, all are tough and leathery, but that's where lichen likeness ends. They range in color, texture, size, and shape, from leafy pale lichens growing on bark to dark tubular ruffles growing in dirt." This is from a writing by Dr. Shane Doyle, and he's a member of the Absaloke tribe. So I wanted to read this because it's a little bit about the pre-European history of our region. He starts, "The area where Big Sky is located today has a long and rich history of being a nexus point for indigenous people from around the region. Archaeological evidence indicates over 12,000 years of hunting, gathering, and trading occurred in the Big Sky Valley, and there are many nations who call this place their homeland. The traditional way of life that existed in the Gallatin River Valley was a seasonal way of life that brought diverse people from distant wintering sites through the area during their summer travels. The Nez Perce, Salish, salmon-eating Shoshone, and Kootenai all utilized the area to harvest and trade on their way both to and from the bison country to the east. The area provided a perfect place for communities of different nations to rendezvous for trade of all kinds, and like today, was visited during the cyclical times of the year, like summer and even during winter, to gather the thick winter hides of bison. From the north, the Blackfeet and Cree would venture through the area for many reasons, especially during the summer and fall, to collect obsidian rock and trade, but rarely during the winter months. The Crow and later the Lakota and Cheyenne used the area to rest, going south to the Land of Steam, also known as Yellowstone Park. From the south, different branches of the Shoshone people would use this trail the most frequently, making the area around Big Sky a top spot on their seasonal migrations to and through the high country of Yellowstone. This diverse history has left little trace of itself over thousands of years of inhabitants and use. The people of the area lived lightly and did not make large impacts on the landscape, evidenced by the overall high quality of the ecosystem that existed since time immemorial. No evidence of tribal conflict or violence has been found in the area around Big Sky, and there are no oral traditions that speak of any bloodshed or battles that have occurred in the valley either, which indicates that a vibrant and robust trade economy likely overshadowed any potential conflict while in the area. The indigenous people of the region moved in something of a circle throughout the year, so they are most accurately described as people of the medicine wheel. Here is some information about what a medicine wheel is and how areas like Big Sky can simultaneously be the homeland from many diverse nations. Medicine wheels are circular rock formations that resemble a wagon wheel, with a pile of rocks in the center and rock lines or spokes that connect the center to the outer edge. They are typically about 80 feet in diameter and can have as many as 28 spokes. The name medicine wheel refers to the pivotal role that these ancient circle maps have played in the Northern Plains people's way of life since time immemorial. With the approximate age of the famous Medicine Wheel National Historic Landmark coming in around 6,000 years old. The wheels are at the heart of the hunter-gatherer trade culture in this region and are important tools for astronomical observation, geographical configuration, seasonal movements, and ceremonial context. The nations who call Montana their homeland all continue to utilize the medicine wheel structure in many ways, primarily ceremonially. The noteworthy Northern Plains Indian ceremony known as the Sun Dance, which is based upon the structure of the wheel and is tied to it through the oral tradition, is still strong within Native communities and is performed every year throughout the state. Medicine wheels are sacred to Native people for many reasons, and they represent the way of life that existed in the Northern Plains for many thousands of years prior to European arrival. The wheels embody a sustainable way of life and a balanced lifestyle where people and all the elements of nature are connected in a circle that is whole. They are relevant and still useful in this area because the open plains allow for a full view of the day and night sky, making it easy to observe and align the rising and setting heavenly bodies with the rock lines on the ground. Since before the last ice age, the native people of the region moved their camps in a seasonal circle, harvesting resources at nature's pace and crossing paths with neighbors with whom they traded. The seasonal rendezvous were so ingrained, neighboring nations with different linguistic heritages developed a universal plains sign language to overcome their communication barriers. Over 100 of these medicine wheels have been identified throughout the northern plains. There are a couple events this week you might be interested in. First off, on January 25th, which is Thursday night at 6:30, there's a talk at the public library, at the Bozeman Public Library, and it is titled Earth to Earth, Dust to Dust, Green Burials. Boy, that sounds like an interesting one to me. It is at 6:30 p.m. in the community meeting room, and you do not have to register ahead of time. And I think I read that they're also running a documentary film in another room that night about UFOs or something. Anyway, could be an interesting night at the library. And then on the 26th, that is the occasion of the full moon, and this is the wolf moon, and the astronomy.com website says the sky this week from January 19th to the 26th, howl at the full wolf moon, and the subtitle says catch Mars in the morning and Saturn in the evenings, along with a full moon and comet Pons Brooks in the sky this week. So that will give you something to look up for into our night skies this week. Good luck. My thanks to Ken Lane for his work on Desert Oracle Radio, and thanks to the Acoustic Atlas, the Macaulay Library, to Awesome Possum and Ursula Vernon, and to Shane Doyle for his writing on medicine wheels. And I also want to thank the book Nature A Day at a Time for their little look into the world of lichens. Thank you, Gallatin Valley, and everyone for listening. You can call and leave me a message or text about anything on your mind. The number is 1-406-404-6246. You can hear this program on the air at 95.9 FM Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgvm.org at 7 p.m. Sunday and 9 a.m. Monday. Our past Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are also available on demand on the kgvm.org website. Till next week, stay well and sweet dreams.
Inextricable.